Hi, and welcome to the Somewhere Frost podcast with me, Jules Stapleton Barnes. My guest today made her maiden speech at the Houses of Parliament at the age of just 20. Before that, from 2015, she was the Member of Parliament for Paisley and Renfrewshire South, and then becoming the Deputy Leader of the Scottish National Party in the House of Commons from 2022 to 2024. She is, of course, the formidable Mary Black. The conversation you're going to hear was recorded in January 2025 in Glasgow, and I meet Mary after she's taken a well-earned break from wrapping her political work up in 2024, moving to the stage for the Edinburgh Festival for her one-woman show and sell-out performances of Politics Isn't For Me. The episode is full of chats about friendship, community, allyship, looking after your mental well-being, whilst hearing quite the insight from Mary about her experiences as a queer, neurodivergent, working class, young politician in Scotland. This is Somewhere For Us. We're here in the Mitchell Library in Glasgow. I'm talking to the legend that is Mary Black.
Thank you. Hello. See how long that status stays.
I know. I'm calling you a legend because this is a word that has come up mm-hmm. with you around several people I know when I've mentioned that I'm going to be speaking to you. So this isn't just me saying it. This is like quite a few people.
Yes.
And you don't kind of get that title of legend, especially when you're still alive at the age of 30.
That's very true.
You don't get it for nothing. What does that feel like for you?
I think no pressure. God, it's it obviously is very nice, you know, and flattering, but it also feels a brass neck at times. You know, for exactly that reason, I think of the people who I think are legends, and I am not in the same category. But
so, why do you think people say it about you?
I imagine certainly in the political world, it was because I think I stood out like a sore thumb for many different reasons. But one of them being that I think I was one of the few that was actually talking their own language, if you know what I mean. I think there was a lot of people who suddenly, when they were looking or listening to me, it was the first time they were able to see someone like them in a position of power, or somebody who talks like them, or, you know, just has the same sort of viewpoint as them. Because the thing that always frustrated me about politics was people, generally, like, the public, think of it as being this really dense and complicated thing that you have to study, and it's really not. It is so simple. It should be as simple as, do you want those children to go to bed hungry? No, I don't. Right, well, let's do something about it. Like, that should be the starting point. Why is it more complicated than that?
That really came across in your maiden speech. So your maiden speech in the Houses of Parliament was in 2015?
2015, yeah.
Yeah, you were 20 years old.
Yep.
And I have watched this clip a few times, but so have millions of others.
Yeah.
It's a well-hit clip. And
they're all my mum, just hitting refresh. That's it.
Good on your mum. The speech is amazing. But the first thing that struck me when I watched the speech back was that you made people laugh really soon.
Yeah.
And that, I think, settled everybody. Because when people laugh, they can relax a bit.
That's exactly why I did it. I remember that. So the way Parliament works is you're not allowed to make speeches until you've made your maiden speech. So when I first got, I get elected in May, and immediately everybody was like, Mary, do your maiden speech. And I was saying, no, I'm waiting. I want to go into that room. I want to sit through a good few debates until I feel like I've got the lay of the land, until I kind of get what the vibe is and everything. And there was a hell of a lot of pressure on me to do my maiden speech dead early.
Who was putting pressure on you?
My own party, my own colleagues, even out with my own colleagues, like, just folk in my life. Well, you should probably do it soon. And I'm glad. I think I was right to go, no, I'll do it in my own time. I'll take my time. So the first thing I realised is, right, this chamber is weird. It's got a different atmosphere than anywhere else. But exactly that conclusion is where I ended up, was going, well, see if you can make folk laugh. Immediately, it just kind of takes a bit of heat out of the room. It takes, you know, suddenly everybody's caught off guard and they're actually listening to you.
Might wake them up as well.
Well, that's
like literally wake
literally,
them up.
Literally, yes.
But it must be weird. Also, when I was watching your clip,
And I just, there's people like lurking, holding their bags, like as if they've just come in.
Yeah.
Does that happen all the time? Like people just walk into the Parliament?
Yep. It's actually, once you understand the rule, it makes sense. So the rule is, I say rule, right, there aren't rules in Parliament, there's just precedents. It's a subtle difference, but it is a difference. Mm. It sounds Tory-ish, is what it sounds.
That's what I mean.
But it's basically the speaker is like the centre. He's the sun in the room, do you know what I mean? And everything has to face him and look through him. So if I'm talking, looking at the speaker, you're not allowed to break the line of eye contact. So
okay, well, that kind of makes sense.
So, like,
because that's important.
Predominantly, right? If it was Labour MPs at that time, because of the layout of the chamber, they would have to walk through my eye line with the speaker in order to get to their seats. So they stand and wait until I'm done talking, and then they can go in. Sometimes people just don't give a toss, you know. And they cut you off anyway. It used to happen to us all the time. But when the chamber's quieter, it's much more noticeable, if you know what I mean. Yeah. When it's busy and it's PMQs, folk just, it's a free-for-all. But
when it's quiet, excuse me.
Yeah.
It didn't happen on your maiden speech.
It did not.
And it landed so well. It's so well. Yeah, so the two things, we got into this straight away. I wasn't planning on getting into this straight away, but there we are. The two things I wanted to mention to you is that you made people laugh. That was quite, there's something quite prophetic about that in terms of where your career is headed just now. But the other thing you did is that you talk about friendship, mm-hmm. and it kind of finishes your speech. You actually make a request of the people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So you've made them laugh. You've said things, really important things about the state of the UK that other people haven't been saying as clearly as you have. And then you ask them for friendship,
yep.
and to come with you on that journey. What was your sense after that? Did you get any of that friendship that you were hoping for?
No, is the honest answer. Eventually, after, I think it was after the 2017 election, it was either 2017 or 19, there were a handful of people that I thought, oh, you're all right. And we did start building these bridges and getting things done, but not on the scale that people need. You know, it was... We could work together to make a meeting happen, or we could work together to, you know, get an organisation into the Parliament, but that's not changing a law. It's all part of a process, but certainly for me, there was only so long I could keep banging my head off that brick wall before I started thinking, maybe I'm the idiot here, willingly banging my head against this brick wall.
How easy was it to trust people?
Not at all. That, to be honest, it's the main reason I got out of it, is because I don't want to live my life like that. I think anyone... This isn't the way it should be, but the reality at the moment and the way that Westminster in particular is designed is it's just self-interest. It's a mixture of self-interest and self-preservation, because there's times when I'm sure... folk will have wanted to work with me, for instance, but I'm not in a place where I can do it. I've had to protect myself. I've had to shut down a little bit. And I think that definitely hinders the process of things. And even when you see it happen, how people can be seeming like, oh, we're really close friends, we're part of a team, and then something happens and they just drop them like a ton of bricks and go to someone else or change their opinion. It's quite startling, you know.
Reminds me of the quote you share around the weather.
Oh yeah,
what do you call it? Weather spinner, weather vanes and
signposts. Yeah. That was actually Tony Benn
came up with that one. Yeah,
But I thought that's exactly.
So there were no signposts.
There were a few, but certainly nowhere near enough, I don't think. So it was really hard to trust folk, and as well. Like, it's something that I've now that I've left politics, I've opened up about. Even with my neurodiversity, I couldn't talk to anybody about it because I knew this is going to get used against me if people find out about it. And that's wrong. And then I would start to beat myself up thinking, I want to be part of the change. And being in the closet about your neurodiversity, is that a good thing? So I started to feel shame for keeping this to myself. But logically, I knew why I was keeping it to myself, because...
Yeah, it made sense to. It does for many folks when they're thinking about their queer identity. It's not always safe to come out.
Yeah.
But it just... You pay a price.
Totally. Yeah. And I think the only reason I was able to keep my mouth shut is because I knew I'm getting out of this. And because I had decided, literally, it was the election night in 2019, I thought, I'm not doing this again. I'm riding out this term and that's it. So I'd already, you know, the countdown timer was going on in my head, even though nobody else was aware of it. So that was where I was able to almost live with myself, hiding this aspect of me, you know.
Such a huge burden to carry.
I mean,
for quite a long time.
So I was diagnosed in 2018, so 2017. So
kind of, you were already up and running.
Yeah.
Living down in London.
It was in the middle of everything. You know, if anything, the diagnosis kind of explained a lot of the mania in my life at that point. So yeah, no, it was quite a long time where I just felt the need to keep it to myself, you know, because I think it was really hard to trust folk. Definitely.
How do you think that both the diagnosis but also your a better understanding of yourself has impacted your life since then?
Oh, it transformed my life completely. The moment I got diagnosed, it kind of confirmed why I seemed to struggle or why I was exhausted after doing things that other people seemed quite able to do. And the biggest thing for me, though, was it gave me permission to stop beating myself up all the time, because I would just end up damaging my own mental health, thinking I should be doing more, this shouldn't be taking this long, I should be, you know, and thinking I'm the problem. Whereas having a formal doctor go, by the way, you're not mad, like, this is, your brain is literally wired differently, so there are these key things that will happen, and accept that these are going to be difficult all your life, so just make small adjustments. And that's what me and my wife and my family have done, and it's transformed things. You know, like, even a number of times, say for instance that me and my wife would argue because I didn't text her back, you know, like, she would be worried, you know, going, I've no heard for you. And in my head, maybe 20 minutes has passed, but it turns out it's been 3 hours, because time blindness is a legitimate thing and I'm riddled with it. So it's like that. Immediately my wife knew, oh, you're not being obnoxious or deliberately rude to me, it's
just reframing things. Yeah.
So like that, she would send me another text and suddenly I'm like, oh my god, I'm so sorry, I didn't realise the time had passed. Do you know what I mean? So it's just wee small things, but they've totally transformed our lives. So yeah,
subtle,
it made a massive difference.
It also means that the other person, and I have experience of this personally too with my wife, that when you understand that certain behaviours are happening not because of you,
they're not deliberate,
and it's not deliberately to upset you or to frustrate you, and when you remove that part of it, then there's so much more compassion you can have. And but also there's responsibility on my part to do differently, to kind of keep an eye on it, but also to adjust things that are very easy to adjust in the way I behave to help life for the other person. And it's not big things, but it's just small things, and you have to know what they are and name them, I think.
Absolutely. So understanding how my own brain works transformed my life. It sounds so painfully simple when you say it like that, but it's true. It took years of struggle to finally get to a point where I'm like, oh yeah, that's just my brain being
My beautiful brain.
Cool.
Love it.
Watch out for issue 18 of our award-winning Somewhere For Us magazine. It includes interviews with Scottish drag superstar Sinéad O'Connor, lip service and EastEnders star Heather Peace, singer-songwriter Mike McKenzie, author Heather Parry, and so much more. Follow us on Insta at @somewhere_for_us to find out more.
What you're doing at the moment, in terms of sharing all these stories and capturing audiences and being able to open up, it's very reflective. So I'm going to ask you, the last time I saw you, we met very briefly because I accosted you at the end of your show, Politics Isn't For Me, at the Edinburgh Fringe, which was August last year.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And you said to me, I'd love to come on the podcast, but I'm going to take a holiday.
Yes.
So I would like to know, did you get your holiday?
I did too, right? I did.
And how are you feeling going into 2025?
Oh, I feel brilliant going into this year, I think, because as well, so the election was in July last year. So I went from, I was still having to do things up until election day. And then after election day, MPs get 4 months it's supposed to be to wind up their office, because you need to get rid of, you know, contracts, leases, make staff redundant, all these sorts of things. And then amongst all that, I had a Fringe show. So I was like, couldn't have planned this worse. So brilliant. And things rolled on to the point where it's only after the new year that I actually feel free of Parliament, because I'm no longer having to deal with...
So that's so recent, because it's January 2025.
Totally.
So now...
I feel free of it. I'm like,
this liberation. You've earned it.
I keep trying to tell myself that, but after 20 minutes on the couch doing nothing, I'm like, right, maybe I should just... I know what I'll do. I'll go into the loft and I'll get it. And my wife comes home. She's like, what the hell have you been doing? I don't know. I'm sorry. This seemed like a good idea at 10 o'clock. I didn't think it would take this long. So
Politics Isn't For Me. This is the show that I came to see in August. Yep. And I went with two amazing people in my life, both in the arts world, and a very good friend of mine, Rach.
Yep.
She was the one that phoned me up and said, oh my God, I've got tickets. Do you want to come? I was like, yes, I do. And when she came out of your show, she was beaming, because she was like, she's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, so it confirmed how she felt about you already. But she was very like, there's more there. Like,
yeah.
She was like, it's not long enough. Like, the hour isn't long enough, was her point.
Yep.
And she really felt the stuff that you couldn't say and couldn't share. And I think from her point of view, and she's a huge Tony Benn, was just like, she wanted you to say more.
That's good.
And we were
talking
about it afterwards. It really sparked a conversation about, like, what could you say?
Yeah.
You know, legally, there's so many things that you wouldn't want to step over or step into. But it's getting that balance right now in terms of using that experience and using your own lived experience of that, which is really interesting for folks to hear, but it's also lifting the lid on really toxic behaviours and systems and culture in the UK government. You know, do you feel that constraint yourself?
Oh, absolutely. God, I mean, it was much worse when I was a politician, because... there's a couple of things, right? I can't lie. I'm a terrible liar, right? I can only lie if there's a good point behind it. Like, see, if you told me we're organising a surprise birthday party for your pal Rach,
she'd be over the moon.
But I would be the most poetic liar ever. She would never find out about that party, because I'd be like, yes, this is for a good reason, we're doing this. But see, if I know, oh God, I shouldn't have done that, or... there's not that good end point. I just can't lie. I can't do it. And that's one of the main reasons I struggled being a politician.
Because people saw through it.
I remember the media team would come to me and say, like, gonna you do this interview? And I'd say, aye, of course I'll do it. But can I remind you, I'm going to answer the question. And like, 9 times out of 10, they'd go, aye, all right, we'll find somebody else. Because they knew, I was like, I'm going to be honest about it.
Yeah.
So in some ways, like, I think that's a good... you know, aspect of my personality, but it was also quite a hindrance in that world.
And you were talking about trust earlier on, and not trusting people, like, you know, the culture, but also people around you. Mm-hmm. Was there any media outlets you trusted?
No. I mean, apart from the fact that most of the mainstream pieces of media are owned by, like, 3 people, it's... You know, trying to find that degree of separation is really different. It's, to be honest, the smaller the sort of group, the more likely I was to do things with them for that very reason, because I thought mainstream media is just so twisted. I mean, even now, what scares me is... In fact, while we're sitting in the Mitchell Library, last time I was in this library, I was studying for uni, and I remember pouring through, like, articles and newspaper articles and things, and they would be legitimate sources of information that I could add into my essay and reference properly. And then I started reading newspaper articles about myself.
Whoa.
And I was like, that's a lot of shit. Like, none of this is true.
Because you hadn't finished your degree, had you, when you started?
That was another chaotic aspect. But, like, that suddenly my faith in... mainstream media.
Because you're using these as sources, and you're like, oh my God, these sources are not correct.
I know that's not true. So this is... So it was quite a kind of... I mean, it was definitely a baptism of fire, put it that way. But no, there was more. There was individuals that I would meet from different outlets where I'd go, "You're all right. You're good." And I would kind of see a bit of how they were kind of in the same situation as me, and that, right, we're part of this organisation. Doesn't mean we agree with everything. We know there's problems within this organisation, but as things stand, we're limited to being part of this group. So let's just do the best we can within our little sphere of influence. So when I met people like that, I gelled with them really well. But like
who
I said,
I guess who are acknowledging it, so that you're not feeling like you're experiencing something that nobody else is.
Totally.
Yeah. Wow.
So there was individuals I would meet, but no, there's no one outlet that I can point at and go, "They're brand new. Always trust them."
Except somewhere for us.
Except this, yes.
Good. What are you most proud of, Mary Black?
Thing I'm proudest of is surviving in that place, you know, like which feels really sad to say, but
no, it's epic. It's epic.
Leaving it and genuinely feeling like, nah, that place hasn't changed me. I'm still, you know, the same person that went in there. I'm really proud of, because I watched it happen to other folk, how they just transformed into something I don't think their previous self would quite have admired. But I think for when I remember all the lives that we managed to impact, and I can't take credit for it because it was the office staff that were doing a lot of it, but hearing about the person that we'd met in a sorry state, they got their house, or they got their money back, they got their things like that, that's what kept me going throughout the whole time, because Parliament's a show pony, do you know what I mean? It's a theatre. Whereas the real stuff that I could actually see the impact that we were having, that was the stuff that I was really proud of. You know, that made me go home and feel like I've done something today. So, yeah, probably that.
Good. I want to take you back to your show.
Yep.
Politics isn't for me. But I am interested in talking about now the decision you made to start the show the way you did.
Yes.
Because as a queer inclusive feminist myself, going into any show where people are going to talk about politics,
and there's, they're going to talk about
there's that you just can't relax.
Yeah,
that just, I have to hear certain things, I have to be reassured by certain language and certain content for me to really relax, particularly when I know issues around queer equality is going to come up, or just people's own lived experience of being queer. And I relaxed pretty quick into your show.
Yeah, totally.
And I felt really safe. On a personal level. I explained this to Rachel and Mike, who were with me at the time. And I was just saying, you know, first of all, it's just so brilliant to see someone like yourself getting up and talking about yourself. And for me, and we've come from different backgrounds, we don't have the same lived experience, but we have something in common, and it felt, you created a safe space for me to be there as an audience member. And I know that would have been the same for other queer people in the audience too. And I'm just wondering, how long did it take you to make that decision to start the show in that way? Which, by the way, what I'm referring to is the fact that you name transphobia and homophobia, and you say this isn't a space for it.
Yeah,
I'm not using your words, but that's the message I got, and I was like, oh, cool. You're setting the tone.
Yep.
I can relax.
That was very deliberate, and it was exactly for that reason. I thought, right, I'm setting the tone here. There's a few things that I just need to establish within the first 5 minutes, so that A, bigots have a chance to walk out if they do and everybody else can enjoy themselves, but also so that those people who aren't bigots in the audience feel a bit emboldened, so that if anyone does start their nonsense, like, we outnumber them in this room.
Yes.
Like, we're in charge here. I got your back, you get mine. That's kind of... So that was very deliberate, but I also knew I can't pontificate here. The point is to be lighthearted and knowing myself... I mean, even just being queer and having to go into predominantly straight places.
It was a pretty white, straight, middle-class audience that was there when I was there.
Oh, totally. I just thought, let's just nip it in the bud.
Yeah,
like for the
that's what it felt like
for the
yeah.
get-go, but also not making it overly serious or pontificating. Mm. Like,
did you get any resistance from your team around you who were helping you mm-mm. develop the show? Or
no, because honestly, it was me in front of a computer.
Right,
there was no big production team or anything. It was literally me phoning up my dad, going, "What do you think of this?"
Well, so how did you end up taking you sitting in a room with your computer?
Yeah,
taking this to as a, to an Edinburgh Fringe show, but now obviously beyond that.
Yeah, so it actually happened backwards. It was a. Sanjeev Kohli is a friend. He was in Still Games in the corner shop, and me and him went and met up a couple of times, and you know, we're just talking, and he was giving me lots of advice and asking for lots of gossip, and I was giving him it. And eventually said, "You know what, you should talk to," and her name's Karen Corrin, who runs Gilded Balloon. And I mean, Karen's a character. She's you know, she started this company, I don't want to say like 50 years ago because I might be making her older than she is, but she started it like 30 years ago or something, and yeah. has managed to, you know, keep it going and has grown into, she's worked with some of the biggest names, yeah. you know, in the industry. And so I met up with Karen, and to be fair, she was actually, she didn't need to really be convinced all that much. She was like, "Yeah, let's go for it. I'll if I can find you a place, let's do it."
So, oh, and, great.
Like, within a week, she came back, like, "Right, okay, we've got a venue. What are you doing, 26 dates?" And I was like, "Right, looks like I'm doing 26 dates.
26 so dates.
Everything, I mean, wow. everything was actually set up. The venue was booked. The tickets were selling as I was still writing it. You know,
wow.
That's what made me get to the computer and get the finger out and actually start
and get
know,
it done.
Pulling it together.
And I suppose there's a bit of a parallel there in terms of performance and having, you know, audiences and turning up and having to do relentless
yeah.
chat.
Yeah. Oh, well, so we would go down on a Monday morning and usually get back maybe a Wednesday night if we were lucky, or a Thursday mm-hmm. we would get home. So it was like 3 or 4 days down there and then 3 or 4 days back up the road.
Yeah. But you'd be used to having to show
like,
up.
Travelling every day from Glasgow to Edinburgh. Don't get me wrong, it was a slog because the journey, like, sometimes you don't know whether it's going to be 50 minutes or 3 days getting through and back. But it was a honeymoon compared to having to fly down to London or get the train or getting kicked off the train at Preston and then having to wait and all this carry on. So, no, it was a welcome difference.
What's your relationship with London now? How do you feel about London?
I don't have one.
And we don't film this podcast, so you can't see the face that Mary just pulled, but I think you're gonna hear it.
No, I think, see, to be honest, I'll enjoy London more the next time I'm there. I've got a few shows in the Soho Theatre in London.
Oh, nice.
So I'm making it a point to go and actually do things, because when we were in London, because of the way that Parliament operates, you were in that building all day, every day. So
With the rats.
Yes. So you didn't really get out.
And I'm talking about the animals. Yeah.
So you didn't really get out to do a lot of sightseeing, mm-hmm. you know. So in like the 10 years I was there, never been up the London Eye. I've never... what else have I not done? Like, there's loads of things where folk are like, "Oh, you must have been to the theatre." Nope.
Like, oh wow!
Votes happen. See, now,
but now you're a performer
yeah.
in the arts world.
Yes,
like you'll be seeing that through a different lens now.
Well, that's what I'm hoping.
So that'll be nice.
That's what I'm hoping. So yeah, I'm ready to have a
re-engage,
a wee refresher of my relationship with London. Put it that way.
Yeah, but it's tied up with a lot of complicated feelings. That, though,
it's the one city in the world that just gives me anxiety because everybody behaves like they're so late. Everyone moves about like they're running so late, and I'm just like, "Gonna everybody take a breather." Everyone just take a deep breath, chill out.
And just call someone and say you're going to be late.
Yeah, just carry on your journey a bit calmer.
It's so different, isn't it?
Our Summer Frost magazine has featured interviews with many of Scotland's inspiring LGBTQ+ role models and icons, including actors Alan Cumming and Annie Wallace, authors Douglas Stewart and Jackie Kay, singers Horse McDonald and Finn Brody, and sports people Bruce Mowat and Robin Love, and many more. Discover more and become a member at summerfrost.org.
How surprised are you with the trajectory of your career?
I don't think about it, to be honest. See, it's strange, right? Because I've never thought of my life as having a career, you know. So when I finished uni, I was already elected, which was mad.
Wow, yeah.
And then you fast forward 10 years and I come out and I'm like, my CV's pretty shit. You know, I worked in a chip shop, I was an MP, and now I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I'm just kind of talking to whatever room's willing to pay me. So it seems strange.
Is it worrying you?
No. Right. No, it doesn't. Because I suppose my approach has just always been, you just take what opportunities present themselves, you know. So long as you're blessed enough to be in a situation where you can do that, then go for it, man. That's so nice.
I'm at a crossroads in my life, but I've been out of the job market for 15 years.
Yeah.
And before that, I was self-employed. So I feel really nervous about it. But you're inspiring me.
Good. No, good, because I suppose...
Because it's going to be okay, and they'll...
I kind of... See, as someone who lives with anxiety, I'm too busy worrying about other things. Do you know what I mean? That's the sort of thing where I'm like, do you know what? Something will figure itself out. Do you know what I mean? Because if it doesn't, then you're dead. So, do you know what I mean? So,
So something has to.
So, something in between that. Something's going to happen. I mean, is that not a description of life itself?
I love it. Definitely is.
So, yeah.
And weirdly, it's comforting. It's really comforting.
So, it's the same way, like, when I was in politics and folk would talk to me about my career, and I'd be like, I don't see this as a career. This is a job. You know, and I'm going to keep trying to do what I can do up until I feel like I can do no more. And that's exactly what I did, you know. So folk would always tout me as being the next First Minister or the next leader of the SNP.
Oh, God, just to touch on that, though, can I just interject?
Uh-huh.
Why weren't you?
Because I value my sanity and my life too.
Yeah,
much.
I know.
I understand that at times you have to play the game. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to work from where you are. And if politics is such a cesspit, then the only way you can get out of that cesspit is by travelling out of it one step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, I think politics has to become, the parliament that you're in has to become the centre of your life. Like, everything revolves around it. And I just wasn't prepared to do that. I thought, this is unhealthy. I'm not doing this to the people that I love.
Mm-hmm.
I also value my own life too much.
It feels like it maybe should be a short-term thing as well, that you shouldn't be in those positions for too long.
See, I'm torn on that, because on the one hand, I think you're absolutely right, that makes sense. But then on the other hand, I recognise that sometimes there's real learned experience that can... I don't think I could have survived to become that without... losing everything that I like about myself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it, certainly from my point of view, it becomes quite a dark and lonely existence. You know, why do you want to spend your time and devoting your life to an environment where you can't trust anyone?
I know, exactly.
Where everyone's out to get you all the time, where your words are twisted, even if you have real good intentions and good meaning behind things.
It feels like you have to sacrifice everything.
Totally. And I just wasn't prepared to do that.
Thank you for sticking it out for as long as you did. And thank you for saying things consistently.
Yeah.
Do you know, that's the thing I really miss with so many people who get the podium and get the opportunity to speak, is that they are weather vanes. They're not signposts, in the sense that, you know, and I say this not really as a political point, more of a personal, but I felt so sad when Nicola Sturgeon went.
Yeah.
Because for me, just with my limited understanding of all the things that she'd shares, there was a consistency around her view of equality for LGBTQ+ people. As far as I'm aware, and people might better correct me.
Yep.
I'm sure there's evidence to say the contrary in some ways, but my impression was that she was consistent, and she was consistent around talking about trans people, which at that time was just so valuable.
Yeah.
And to lose that, and knowing 100% that the person coming into that position next is not going to do that, was pretty unnerving, and also just felt sad.
It was even worse when you're... if you think you're here out in the public, Nicola's up here, I'm the definition of middle management. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Between that. So when she went, I'm in the organisation, I know things that you're not privy to.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be a bloodbath. This is going to be horrific. And sure enough, it was horrific.
How did it feel for you when she announced? Did you find out before she announced? Or
Very briefly.
Yeah.
Before. Okay. I mean, it was... I think I was more alarmed than disappointed or anything like that, because I thought something else is going on here. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're getting the full story.
It didn't feel like the right time for her to go.
Yeah.
For herself.
The events that transpired after it, things started to make a little bit more sense. But certainly before all that came out, I was just very much, we're losing an ally here.
Yeah, that's how it felt. And I was simplifying it. I understand that. I know it's complicated. And, you know, she stood for lots of other things.
Don't get me wrong, because I do feel that I need to say that there were times where I think she could have done more and could have been a bit bolder or a bit more consistent in how it was applied, you know, to the party, to the SNP as a whole.
Because it didn't feel like it filtered throughout the party.
No, not at all. And being
which is why I knew the next person coming in wouldn't be the same.
Exactly. So if you could see that on the outside, imagine what it was like on the inside, where you were hearing all these private discussions and folk hitting it with things. And I'm saying this, I don't know the full story from her point of view. Like I'm saying, you have to play the game at times, so there could be other factors that I'm totally oblivious to. But there were times where it felt like, no, you're in charge, so lay down the law with them.
Yeah.
Instead of just letting it fester and build and build and build. These corners of the party where bigots do exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Deal with it, because if you're going to practice...
Like in any organisation, right?
And if you want... You have built up a lot of credibility, rightly, about allyship, but you're undermining your own message here.
Yeah.
And I think I was feeling really frustrated and hurt before any of this happened. It'd been going on for a long, long time. So then when she finally did announce that, it was just like a punch in the gut, going, oh God, this is getting even worse. I thought we were at the, you know, kind of the bottom of the valley, but no, it turns out there's a whole other
dip. Do you stay in touch with Nicola?
Yeah, I saw her a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it was at the launch of the Glasgow Comedy Festival. She was at it. There was actually a moment that made me laugh, because three acts came on, and one of them went out of the crowd and was like, right, I'm looking for two volunteers, and me and Nicola hit the deck. It's like,
No doing that. I was actually, the last time I was thinking about Nicola Sturgeon was when Janey Godley died.
Yeah.
And I had sort of floods of memories coming back about those two, that just the relationship between those two.
Yeah.
Not in the same room, but just what it all meant. And
yeah. Yeah. I think the one thing Nicola Sturgeon had that I don't think any other politician or any other leader has managed to capture yet is her humanity shone through.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, for sure.
She was human and she was the most, I think, capable and articulate, matter-of-fact kind of person, but then knew when to, I'll be a bit of human here, or I'll crack a joke here, or I'll soften, show a compassionate side, you know. Like, there was a picture I remember of, she was visiting a play park or something, or it was like a toddler's group or whatever, and there was a beam, and it was like a gymnastics thing, and she walked across the beam, and it's a photo of her standing balanced and walking across it, and it just oozed confidence. And I was looking at it and I was going, you would not catch another party leader even attempting that.
Because just in case they fall.
Totally.
Wow.
I thought, that's the Nicola Sturgeon I know, just that total, I'm in control here, but I'm still human. Do you know what I mean? It's just one
thing. That's a great image, actually.
That stood out to me, where I was like, nobody else would do that. That's because you're still a normal person to an extent.
Wow. Can we talk about community?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so you've mentioned your wife.
Yes.
So obviously you've got a kind of personal community of people around you at home who you love and everything. Where do you find a sense of queer community? Like, is that important to you? Is that something that resonates with you?
As I get older, I think I get more queer.
Yeah, me too.
You know what? I think it's... Yeah. So
that's interesting. I think I do too.
Absolutely, I value the community, but more so because... So I grew up... you know, went to Catholic schools, big Catholic family, went to mass every week and everything. So it took me quite some time. It probably wasn't until I was about 18 or 19 that I really unpicked a lot of the internalised homophobia. That, don't get me wrong, I grew up in the most loving family you will ever imagine, right? But that's kind of where it clicked for me. If I'm feeling this with
in a loving
all of
family.
The support and love that I've had, then God, what are folk who don't have that support living through it? And suddenly I was just able to appreciate it so much more and the importance for it. And the older I get, that just gets more and more reinforced. So I lean into it harder and harder, you know. So I'm the campest I've ever been in my life, you know, because if you're a butch lesbian, you just need to be, matter of fact, you know, get my Fred Perry polo shirt and I'm going to football, you know, which I still do, to be honest, but I sing Celine Dion the entire journey. So,
isn't it great, though, that because there's so many more spaces now and more conversations about, like, expression and how you express your sexuality, how you express your gender identity, and for me, I can't separate the two. My queerness is just
absolutely
all over.
Yeah,
so
couldn't hide it if I tried.
Yeah, so there is something, I think, when we start to, it's so healthy for a community to make fun of its stereotypes a little bit, because we can also look at those and just sort of tear them apart a bit.
Yeah,
and I think young people now are, I think they get it more than we do, because I think our boxes were a bit
enclosed and rigid,
yeah. Whereas I think now a lot of young folk do feel more fluid.
And I think that's also part of the internalised homophobia. It's, right, okay, I accept that I'm gay, but I need to be this kind of gay.
This kind of gay.
Because that's more understandable, you know, or palatable to the outside world. And that's just rubbish. You know?
Or at least there's a safety in not sitting in the ambiguity.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe. Oh, I just love the potential for people to be absolutely anything.
Yeah.
Wear absolutely anything that makes them feel comfortable.
Yeah.
And use any language they want, as many letters as possible, because that is what personal empowerment feels like.
Yeah.
I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Mary. Check out more of the interview in issue 18 of our Somewhere For Us magazine. Discover more and become a member at somewhereforus.org.
See, where I feel so supported is when occasionally, it maybe happens once every, it's not happened for a while, mind you, but there was a period of time where it was like once every 6 weeks I'd get a text or a phone call from my mum going, Mary, I'm just double checking, am I woke? I'd be like, aye mum, you're woke shit. Right, am I a TERF? And I says, no, you're not a TERF. Right, so I'm not a TERF, but I'm woke. Right, that's fine, thanks, just double checking, making sure I've got the internet lingo right, because, and I know she's a way to argue with folk on Twitter, like that's why she's asking.
Amazing.
She just wants to double check before she picks a fight.
That is so funny. And that's about language, isn't it?
Oh,
it's about labels and language. Yeah. And just like, she knows who she is, but she just needs to make sure she gets the words right.
Totally
Oh, I love it,
you know,
that's
but
so good.
For somebody in their 60s to be that open and willing and learning and everything.
What's your mum's name?
Helen.
Good on you, Helen.
The bold Helen.
Woke but not a TERF. What message would you give to anyone who may feel fearful of coming out and living their most authentic life? And I mean coming out in relation to their queer identity or their LGBTQ plus identity, but also...
Or even their allyship,
Or even just understanding how their brain works.
Yeah, totally. Do you know, it makes me think of the film. I mean, it's a problematic lead actor, but Milk, about Harvey Milk. There's a scene in that film that I saw when I was maybe about 14 or something that was my... It was a eureka moment almost, and it still resonates with me today, where it's halfway through the film, they're basically getting beaten by all the forces against them. Everything feels depressing and down, and they're all in a room, and Harvey Milk says, right, do you know what we're going to do? We're all going to come out. And of course the room's filled with horror, and they're like, no, we're in danger and everything. And he goes, no, we're coming out, because see, if we all do it, all those folk out there, it's not going to be some scary little queer person, you know, that's a no-faced figure that's coming to, you know, morally corrupt their children. Suddenly it's their brother, or it's their cousin, or it's their best pal, or somebody they work with. It humanises it. And I mean, that just blew my mind at the time. I was thinking, that's exactly what you need to do.
Strength in numbers.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, I think not come out, because everybody's got to do it in their own time, right? And in their own way. And I wouldn't want to, you know, rush or shame somebody for not doing it. But ultimately, it's got to be the end goal for you, because so long as you live your life not being your authentic self, you're not really living your life. You're living the life you think that other people will approve of, and that's not yours. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So why are you giving up your entire life to folk who, quite honestly, don't deserve it? And even if the people around you, or you're fearful that your loved ones will reject you and everything, I can't imagine what that's like, because I've had all the love and support. But what I do know for definite is, even if they reject you, there's an entire world that's going to open you, or that's going to open their arms wide to you and pick you up and become your family. You're never going to be alone because of your queerness. It's just a case of getting yourself into the right spaces or with the right people. Everything stems back to that scene for me of just going, no, come out, just be yourself. What are people going to do? Do you know what I mean? They can't ignore us. There's never been a world without queer people, and there never will be a world without queer people. So let's stop pretending. Do you know what I mean?
There is a really obvious reason why people call you a legend. There is.
I really thought you were going to say lesbian there, and I was like, we gave it away.
People sometimes call you that. Yeah. There is a reason why people call you a legend.
Oh, well, thank
because
you.
Because you speak the truth, but you speak it in such a way that I can understand it. Brilliant. I believe in it. I want it for me. I want it for other people. I want it for our whole community.
Excellent.
It's very uplifting.
Good. I'm glad.
Thank you so much. Thinking about going a bit darker now, just for a minute, but I want to bring us to the light as well. Thinking about the daily onslaught of the threat to LGBTQ rights as individuals that we're all feeling, I think, here and across the world, how do we stay motivated as a community? How do we stay and build resilience? How do we continue a fight for equality when things feel so bleak on some days?
See, for me personally, when I feel really dejected and downhearted, and God, I had it when I was watching about 5 minutes of the inauguration, and just thinking, the Nazis are back in power. Why are not enough people saying it? So like that, when I get really defeated, I've always taken inspiration from the older gays, you know, the older trans and just the older queers, because don't get me wrong, there are some folk that you meet where I think, oh, you are 60, but you've still riddled with internalised homophobia.
Still in those rigid boxes, right?
Yeah, so they do exist. But then there's folk... I mean, so the person that's jumped into my mind is a former colleague of mine, John Nicholson, who is the biggest queen there is, right? So talented, journalist, you know, news presenter and everything. And listening to him just being really calm and funny about it all, it just kind of reminded me, look, we've been here before. We survived it then. We're going to survive it now. We're still here. And just having that voice of reassurance when I'm thinking, God, you did go through so much worse than what's happening right now, and you're still here, and you're still a beacon of hope for me, who's supposed to be picking up the mantle of the next generation, but here you are, still inspiring.
It's people so needed.
Where I think, nah, you're right,
we're going to be okay.
Yeah, and it's all stepping stones, you know, and if you try and get to the next stepping stone and you pull up as many people as you can onto it with you, and then if you can get up another one, go for it. But if one's all you achieve in your lifetime, you're still further ahead than you were when you were born, or where the world would be without you.
Yeah. And we were talking a little bit in the office actually this week around the fact that, you know, even though you can feel that the clock's been turned back, if legislation is rolling back, or if rights are, if you feel like the rights are under threat, it doesn't mean that the hearts and minds will go back.
Totally.
And it's taken this long to beginning to, you know, to change hearts and minds to get us to this point. And that also includes people within the community and working on all that work that people have done on the internalised transphobia, internalised bi and homophobia. That doesn't get undone. So even though your government might be doing things to take your rights away.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot stop you. Yeah. To quote Alok Menon recently, they can't take away your joy. They just can't do that.
Oh, totally.
And yeah. that's not in their power. And they can't take away what's been. And that journey that people have come on and the journey that your friend has been on and has experienced and committed to, that doesn't get rolled back.
Totally.
And so we aren't going backwards in that way. We've learned so much. We've galvanised. We've gathered people that we trust and care for. And, you know, you were saying earlier on, you don't trust anyone in politics. But I think there are so many people in a queer community right now I do trust.
Yeah.
As beacons, do you know?
Absolutely.
And they can't take that from us.
Yeah, totally, totally. And it's, I think the other aspect which I totally think is the reality just now is that the vast majority of people are either too poor, they're struggling too much, they're too exhausted, or they're too busy. And I mean busy in the sense of they're working three jobs and trying to keep a house clean and making sure their kids are okay and getting to school. They don't have time to actually stop and reflect on the direction of travel of a country. That's too macro. Like, when you're the biggest issue in your life every day is, how am I going to make it to tomorrow?
Yeah, yeah.
Then no wonder you're not really... what are you going to do? You feel powerless. Like, yeah, Elon Musk is up there doing a Nazi salute. What do you want me to do about it? Do you know what I mean? And I can understand that. So there's a bit of me that's thinking, even though we can see the trajectory and it is alarming and it is dangerous and we've been here before and it went a very ugly route, I don't think we're necessarily at that point right now, because there's still too many people who I think the minute it would impact their life or their gay son or their lesbian daughter or their trans cousin or whatever, suddenly it would spark them. It would make them pay attention and start defending exactly what we're trying to defend.
Yeah.
It's just that there's so many different factors at play in different people's lives, if that makes sense. You know, it's not just bigotry's taking over.
It's noisy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is so much information. There's so much information coming at you from all different directions that you don't, you were referring to the media earlier, like you don't know who to trust, you don't know what, so you kind of shut down.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily know what kind of information is going to be useful for you and your family. Mm-hmm. You can't take it all on board.
Yeah. Nobody is asking you to change the world. If anything, change your world, if you know what I mean. So, like, I mean, my dad telling me recently that he was at with a group of guys his age, and one of them called something gay and then doubled down on it by saying poof about something, right? And my dad thought, I know this guy, he's a nice guy. Like, I know he doesn't think like this. So he thought, right, I'm not going to embarrass him in front of everybody, which is probably what I would have done, to be honest. You know, just jumped down his throat. But my dad didn't, and I think he did the right thing. He waited until it was quiet, and he just pulled him aside and said, by the way, I really didn't appreciate that. And the guy was like, oh God, you know, the minute I said it, I thought, why am I doing this? He says, but you know, it's a different time, and we grew up in the 70s. And I says, no, I know. But here's how I know you can do better, because you're the same age as me, and I'm doing better. And he was like, do you know what, you're right, Alan. And that was it.
Yeah.
He's changed that guy. That's what you can do.
And it's one of your peers.
Yeah.
Who you respect and care about.
Totally.
The difference between you doing it or your dad doing it was about going in with an understanding that we have the same lived experience.
Yep.
And there's that potential.
And I think it's also, it's so much more effective, and it's so much easier to change someone's mind when they're already on side with you, just as a human. Do you know what I mean? If they already see you as a friend or as somebody they can trust or somebody that they can listen to. So when you do say something, especially if it's in a gentle, matter of fact, but gentle manner, then you can't do any more than that. You know, that is how you change minds. And, you know, at political meetings and things, people would say to me, how do we get through to folk? And I can tell that folk don't like my answer, but it's the honest one, is genuinely the way you change the world is by changing it one mind at a time. All you can do is influence your circle, so make sure you're doing it. That's what your responsibility is. Don't be sort of bringing yourself down thinking, oh, I need to take on every single person every single time. No, you do what you can when you can. And if we all do that, it adds up, you know?
Yeah.
Yep.
It's very nice listening to you.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I knew you were going to be articulate. Like, I knew you'd be able to handle a conversation because it's, you know, you're Mary Black. But I think there's a relaxedness about you though.
It's called happiness now.
I was going to say that is exactly the word. It sounds so silly, but you look happy.
Oh, I feel it.
Happy for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You know, it's really, really important that your voice doesn't go anywhere as well. And I love that because you've got so much insight that's helpful, not just to complain about it, to help do things differently.
Yeah.
And I think that whole, you know, changing minds one by one.
Yeah.
Your shows, your stand, whatever you call it. Do you call it stand up?
I don't, because it feels like a brass neck, but everybody else is.
Yeah. So I'm like, you're doing it. You're using your platform for good.
Yeah.
It's a superpower, Mary Black.
Thank you very much.
It is. It's a superpower, and it's really nice to not lose you from that public sphere.
Ah, cheers.
I would understand why you might want to take a step back every now and again. But
it was more because, like that, I do enjoy meeting people and talking to people and also tackling kind of big or what seem big, scary ideas, but I also might have a laugh. Well, you do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's what was missing from the 10 years in politics, was there was no room for humour. And sometimes rightly so, but I can't live like that, you know.
No.
I need to be able to laugh, particularly the darker things become.
Yeah.
I need to be able to laugh about it.
I've got a lovely friend who used to work in palliative care,
mm-hmm.
and she always talked about the value of laughter
at the
end of people's lives.
Totally.
You can't work in a place like that and not give people space to let go.
Yep.
Got to create an environment where you can let some tension out.
Totally.
Because it's a really tense environment.
And even for the person themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, losing about an hour of my life just daydreaming about what's the point of laughter? Like, it's such a random thing that we all do. So it must be important because, like,
yeah,
why else would you do it? Like, we know why we cry. We know why what we do when we get hungry. But why laughter? Like, what does...
Yeah.
What purpose does it serve? Well, it must serve a purpose.
What does it serve for you?
Oh, it keeps me sane. You know, it's the kind of... I feel like no matter what's happening in a room or how heated a room gets, the minute something funny happens and we all share a bit of laughter, we're back on the same level. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of... Right, we're all
it's
still...
It's a universal experience, isn't it, to be able to laugh at stuff.
Aye.
Thank you so much for taking
for
time.
Me.
Thank you so much for taking time
to
come into this wee room.
I know, I'm enjoying it. It's nice.
It's something. It's quite nostalgic.
Being able to talk in a library.
I know.
It's great.
I make loads of noise in this library. They must hate me. It's great. Thanks for joining us on Someone
Else. Oh, thank you,
Mary
for
Black.
Having us.
I don't know why I said your name again at the end. You know who you are.
Just in case. Thank you. Cheers for having us.
I really enjoyed that, and I hope you did too. Thank you so much for listening to the Somewhere For Us podcast with me, Jules Stapleton-Barnes, and thank you, Mary Black, for a great conversation. For more episodes that celebrate our community and champion queer voices, visit somewhereforus.org/podcast. And if we're not connected already, follow me on Instagram, somewhereforus_podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else you listen. This is Somewhere For Us.